You have the lesson before you there, dealing with the book of Daniel. This is the lesson we teach in the school on Monday night, and we give a repeat of it here on Sunday morning. This is a very practical lesson and doesn't have so much to do with prophecy, but I believe it is a good lesson and one that we all could stand to hear more than one time even. So we're not going to take up a lot of preliminaries here because we want to go down to the end of chapter 1 of the book of Daniel. And in order to do that, we're going to have to move with some degree of speed. Now we give the outline here and then we'll give some of the details about the lesson. But in verses 3 to 7, we have the introduction of the four Judeans. These four young men, probably about 15 years old, somewhere near that, that have been brought as captives from Babylon, or rather brought from the land of Israel over there to the land of Babylon as captives. Looking at a few facts that are stated there, we'll begin our reading at verse 3 of Daniel chapter 1. And the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel, and of the king's seed, and of the princes. So looking at the information in the latter part there, verse 3, we find that the choicest young men were brought to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar. Not the slums, not the Skid Row section, but the choicest of the people. Now, why did he bring these people from Judea there over to Babylon? They were not so much captives as they were people to be educated. Nebuchadnezzar was really a very wise king. What he really did was to bring these people over there from Judea to school them in the ways of the Babylonians, that they might add whatever knowledge and ability they had to the well-being of his kingdom. So he was not a foolish king, he was a very wise king. So he brought them over there to strengthen his rule, and it was not a form of punishment. As oftentimes you hear this word, you know, captive, and you have the idea, well, this fellow's he's a prisoner of some kind. In the absolute sense, they were not prisoners. They were students to be trained in the school of Babylon. Now, the term eunuch that we have here and elsewhere in the Bible does not always of necessity refer to people that have been castrated. Now, most of the time, it does have that meaning in the Bible. You say, well, why was it so? Well, those kings, with their harem of wives and all, when they brought in these young men, they made sure they behaved. Just put it blunt, that's what it was. But now, the term eunuch, at least a few times in the Bible, refers even to a married man, like in the case of Potiphar, Genesis chapter 37. Potiphar had a wife, so he was a courtier or a eunuch there in the court of the Pharaoh, but nevertheless he was a married man. So the term eunuch generally would indicate a male man that has been castrated, but would at times merely just mean a courtier, a fellow that had a position in the court, worked with the king. He may or may not have been a castrated man. Now Josephus, the historian, says that all of these boys were made eunuchs as soon as they were brought to Babylon. However, there's no statement in the Bible to corroborate that. The only evidence that would lend support probably to the idea is the fact that these boys are never said to be married anywhere throughout the book of Daniel. So he may be right about it. I don't know. But now only the royal blood was taken. Those that were noble and of royal blood. Let's go back over there to Kings and look at that 20th chapter. 2 Kings chapter 20. Verse 16 to 18, and you'll see something about the captives that were taken there. 2 Kings chapter 20. Now let's read a word or two found here, beginning at verse 16. And Isaiah said unto Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord. Behold, the days come that all that is in thine house, that which thy fathers have laid up in store unto this day, shall be carried into Babylon. Nothing shall be left, saith the Lord. This prophecy is very significant in that it was written a year before the Babylonian captivity took place. or at least before that, long before that, and of thy sons that shall issue from thee, which thou shalt beget, shall they take away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. So the prophet there clearly predicts, Isaiah the prophet, that there would be captives taken from Judah of noble blood of the king's seed, and they would become eunuchs in the palace of Babylon. That was all foretold by God long before it actually took place. Again, we have the prophecy of the Bible proving the Bible to be the Word of God. Now let's go and read verse 4 there in Daniel chapter 1. He tells about, the fact that they are to be healthy and intelligent. So there were requirements for these that would become students in Babylon. Children in whom was no blemish. Not only that they were healthy, but they looked good. Handsome young men, we'll put it like that, who didn't have short arms or legs missing and deformity of some sort in their face and the like. Children in whom was no blemish, but well favored and skillful in all wisdom. That's the intelligent part, see. And cunning in knowledge and understanding science. The scholars, in other words, educated people, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace. Now that would involve more than just being healthy and being intelligent. It would involve the talent of being diplomatic in the court, being able to have a good personality and to deal with people. So the king wanted the best qualified men he could find anywhere in the world to be courtiers there in the court of Babylon. So these captives had to be healthy, they had to be intelligent, and that would mean that Daniel and his friends were such. And as I state here, he was probably from 12 to 15 years old, perhaps no more than 15. I would guess, if I had to, probably right at about 15 years old. Now why did he want to take these men young like that? Well, they hadn't been taught so much in the religion of Judea, though these fellows had, as we're going to see. And so they were taken because they were young enough they could still be taught. You probably have heard the old slogan that you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Well, I guess the king somewhat subscribed to that. He took the young men that he felt like that he could teach the truth to. So he didn't want fellows that didn't know how to behave in the court, that would bring embarrassment to the king when somebody would come in from a foreign nation. We have people just like that working in the United Nations. They have to have not only good looks, but they also have to be intelligent. They have to be able to speak various languages, and they have to know how to deal with people of other nationalities. So the king here is putting down pretty much the same requirements that our nation probably has and those that hold office in the United Nations. So then we pass on down to look at verse 5, and we find here that they're going to have a very special privilege. While they may not altogether eat right at the king's table, shoulder to shoulder with him, they're going to eat the king's food that comes from the table. And so that's going to be a very honored privilege to have. And the king appointed them. Now this wasn't something that was done on the spur of the moment or some master of the eunuchs did, but it was something that the king himself did. The king appointed a daily portion of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. So they're going to have the same menu there that the king had. Now, why do you suppose that the king did that? We don't really know, but I would imagine it would have been for the reason that I state there. This was to secure the goodwill of the young men and to keep their bodies healthy. So he had a twofold purpose: to let them know that they were his honored guests, and that he wanted them to fare well in his kingdom, which was good psychology, to say the least. Now, when it speaks there about standing before the king, and many times in the book of Daniel, we'll come across this expression, to stand before the king. It doesn't just merely mean to go in and appear before the king. It means that, but it means more than that. In this particular case, it means to stand before the king and be examined and investigated. And then after that, it means that they would have the privilege of being courtiers. They would be men that would work in the palace with the king and the government. So it would indicate a political position as well as an honored privilege. All of that is intended there by the statement to stand in the king's palace and to stand before the king himself, because it was a great honor that day to stand before the king. So they were going to be courtiers. They're going to be courtiers as well as eunuchs in the palace. Now, most significant thing we see there in verse 6 and 7, their names were changed. Their names were changed. Now, among these were of the children of Judah. There's more captives than these four. I want you to note that. And these four will be the only ones that won't compromise. The others will. Just like today, we have some that'll compromise and some that won't. Now, among those were of the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, unto whom the prince of the eunuchs, that's Ashpenaz, back up there in the third verse we read, who's the chief or prince of the eunuchs. Now, unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names. Now, they've got Hebrew names. That's what we have in verse 6. And in verse 7, they're going to be given Chaldean names for a very particular reason that I'll point out. Unto whom the princes of the eunuchs gave names, for he gave unto Daniel the name of Belteshazzar. That's almost the same spelling of that ruler in the kingdom of Babylon in chapter 5 that's called Belshazzar. There's a little difference in the spelling, though. This is Belteshazzar. And to Hananiah of Shadrach, and to Mishael of Meshach, or Meshach, and to Azariah of Abednego. So now the names are Hebrew in verse 6. But they're being changed in verse 7 to Chaldean or Babylonian names. I spent considerable time looking up the meaning of these names in the original tongues. And I found out that the name Daniel, which we gave in the first lesson, means God is my judge. But his name was changed to Belteshazzar, which means Baal's treasure. Baal is one of the gods of Babylon. He's mentioned in Isaiah 46 and 1 as one of the gods of Babylon. He's mentioned again as a god of Babylon in chapter 4 and verse 8. If you just want to look over there in Daniel 4 and verse 8, you'll find that you have this statement. Now at the last Daniel came in before me, whose name was Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God. The king said, my God. See, not his God, but my God. Now, what's the idea in all of this name change? Well, they're going to try to make good Babylonians out of these boys. Give them Babylonian names and hope that they'll forget the God of Judah and begin to worship the gods of Babylon. That's the purpose of this name change. So Baal is indeed one of the principal gods of Babylon. Later you'll find that same God, so far as I'm concerned, spelled B-A-L-L, Baal. Days of the prophets, you remember later in the Bible. Same old false God, though. So there's quite a bit taking place here. Now, if you look at some of these words like Daniel, you see what? El on that. That's a Hebrew word for God, El. Elijah, see there? My God is Jehovah. Elijah, that El. All right, you have El there. In a lot of these names, you have in Daniel, you've got El, and then you've got Mishael. See the E-L on the end of that? That's the Hebrew word for God. So they're named in connection with their God. Now then, if you look at the other names, they end in A-H. A-H. Hananiah and Azariah. You got A-H. That's a form of the word Jehovah. J-A-H, see, is the root of that word. So I'm showing you here that all of their names corresponded to the true God, Jehovah, Yahweh, as he was called in the Old Testament. So then they keep on this change here. Hananiah, which means Yahweh is gracious in the Hebrew, was changed to Shadrach, which means the messenger of the sun. Or it can mean illuminated by the sun god, which points out clearly that they were giving this boy a name in honor of the sun god in Babylon. And then Mishael, which means he who is as God, or could mean who is like God, is another possible translation of that, was changed to Meshach, which means who is like Venus, who is an earth god in Babylon, or who is like Shaq, and Shaq is a god in Babylon. If you'll read the Old Testament, you'll find that out. Shaq is a god of Babylon. And then Azariah, which in the Hebrew means Yahweh has helped, was changed to Abednego, which means the worshiper of Nebo, the fire god. In Isaiah 46:1, you'll find that it mentions there this god Baal and also this god Nebo. Nebo's the fire god. The fire god. Now the king is changing their name in hope of changing their religion. When Joseph went over to Egypt, they gave him a new name, same reason. When Esther was declared to be the queen under the reign of King Ahasuerus, there in Persia, she had her name changed to correspond to the country in which she found herself. So that was a common custom in that day. But now as we go down to verse 8 and 10, we're going to see Daniel's courage. He was a most courageous man. First of all, let's read verse 8. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now let's look at that for a few moments there. Why would not Daniel eat meat and drink wine? That was not too uncommon for the Jews. Well, the eating of a lot of meats was because there were certain meats they wouldn't eat. In Leviticus chapter 11, verse 1 to 47, there's a list of all of these kinds of meat that they found to be ceremonially unclean. They wouldn't eat of them. Of course, swine or pork, whatever you want to call it, was one in the list. Catfish and the like, we could mention that. Some fowls were also in that list. But anyway, there was still another reason why he probably would not eat of that meat. He said, well, what was wrong with the meat? It was dedicated to the idol gods of Babylon. You see, they would slay these animals in sacrifice, and then they would take the meat out and sell it. But they dedicate these animals to the gods of Babylon. So in a sense, if Daniel were to eat the meat of Babylon, he would be paying homage to the gods of Babylon. And that he would not do. So he was a great non-compromiser. Then there was another problem that he had. The Babylonians were not particular about how they got the blood out of the animals they killed. There in Leviticus 17:10-14... you find that the Hebrews could not eat animals that didn't have the blood drawn out of it. God told them not to eat blood. That's still a good rule to follow today. And so there were about three reasons there that Daniel would have refused not only the meat but also the wine. The meat could have been swine or catfish. It could have not had the blood drawn. Or it probably was all offered to idols. Even the wine itself was dedicated to idols. He could not therefore drink the wine without paying homage to the gods of Babylon. So sometimes when it comes to this false worship, we may not be sensitive enough. Here was a man that refused to drink wine and eat meat rather than pay any sort of respect to false gods. Pretty strong, wasn't it? Now the king had ordered this menu, and to refuse it would have spoiled all chances, it would seem at least, of any advancement in the kingdom of Babylon. After all, they're in a foreign country. Now, to violate the very first order of the king could have meant death. Because kings in that day didn't fool around. If you didn't do what they said, they'd just kill you. So Daniel is really a man of courage in what he's doing here. And what he's showing us is that we must be regulated in our conduct, not by human standards, but by the divine standard of what saith the word of God. Do what God said, not what man said. And so he's going to stand up for his faith, what he believes. Now, I suppose he would have been tempted, in a sense, to compromise. Here he is in a foreign country, and most of the other Judean boys have compromised. They're already eating the king's meat and drinking his wine, you see. He could have said, well, now look, it'll get me killed, and if I get killed, I can't witness for Jehovah here in Babylon, so I believe I'll go along and eat the meat, and I'll drink the wine, and that way I'll have opportunity to witness to somebody. He didn't reason that way. He said, no, I'm not going to pay any homage to these gods of Babylon, because if I do, they'll believe their God is as good as my God, and it's not true, so I won't do it. So he was a man of great courage. Now, the latter part of that, the way it reads there, that he might not defile himself, he requested of the prince of the eunuchs. In other words, he explained why he couldn't eat the meat and drink the wine. It was dedicated to idols. So now, while we object to other people's religion, we don't have to be mean about it. He didn't attack the gods of Babylon and say a lot of dirty things about them. He just said, according to my conscience, I can't do this. It's not right for me to do it, and I don't want to have to do it. So I asked to be excused from eating this meat and drinking this wine. And so it seems that this fellow is not too excited about going along with that from what follows there. And the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, I'm in verse 10 now, I fear my lord the king, who hath appointed you meat and you drink, for why should he see your faces worse lacking than the children which are of your sort? See, there's more there than just Daniel and his companions. Then shall you make me endanger my head to the king. So he's in a sense saying there, I respect your feelings. I know you're a man of conscience and all of that. But I'm going to get into trouble if you don't obey the king's instructions. I'd be glad to do it, but I don't have the final say. It's Nebuchadnezzar that has the say, and he said, you're going to do it. So he's being understanding, but he's saying, I don't see how that I can go along with it. But Daniel is not the sort of fellow to give up. He doesn't just give up at the least problem. A lot of times, you know, if we try to serve God and we encounter some sort of difficulty, we'll say, well, we believe we'll just not do it, you know, we'll just quit. Well, this plan didn't work, so he conjured up a second plan to get out of it. After all, the chief of the eunuchs doesn't have all the say, because the little eunuch that's over him has some say, called here the Melzar, which is actually just a fellow underneath this prince of eunuchs, another teacher in the school, we'll call him, because that's about the best way to express it here. It said there in verse 9 that Daniel, of course, had been brought into favor now with this prince of the eunuchs. But he still is reluctant to go along with that request. He doesn't want to go along with it because he's afraid he's going to get himself in trouble with the king. Isn't it remarkable how that when Joseph went down to Egypt, that God brought him into favor with the people that he associated with? Why? Because the Bible says, when a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. Proverbs 16, verse 7 will tell you that. So whenever we serve God, we'll find out that we'll have some favor from man as well. And those men that will not respect us following the dictates of our conscience are not our friends, nor are they worthy of the least bit of consideration on our part. That's exactly how Daniel felt, and I believe that's how we all should feel. So Ashpenaz is reluctant to go along with it. Even though he respects Daniel, he believes he's a man of conscience and all that, he still says, I believe we better not do it. We'll get into trouble. So now Daniel is going to make a second request, a request for trial. That's what we have in verse 11 down through 16. Then said Daniel to Melzar, that's the steward, our the guard, whatever you want to call him. I'd call him an instructor in the school from what I read here, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, and Mishael, and Azariah. So now he's going to make a plea here to be able to follow his religion. You see now, he doesn't go in, he doesn't attack the gods of Babylon, he doesn't say a lot of ridiculous things, he's very diplomatic, but nevertheless, he states his conviction very strong. There's a difference in a man stating his conviction and a man just being plain ornery and contrary sometimes. And I'm sure this man here could tell the difference. So now he's gone in to the guard, or the steward, and he pleads that he might be permitted to practice his religion. And he proposes a test here, really, in a sense, between the gods of Babylon and Jehovah is what it amounts to. Though he doesn't come right out and say that, that's what it amounts to. In other words, let me serve my God and see if it hurts me. See whether or not it's better to serve my God than to serve your gods. So that was really a test between the gods. So he doesn't come right out and attack the gods of Babylon. He said, let me serve my God. That's all he said. So look at the proposition that he makes there in verse 12 and 13. Prove thy servants. Try thy servants. I beseech thee 10 days. Now it's going to be a 3-year school. And he said, surely you could stand a 10-day trial. Well, that was a small request. And let them give us pulse to eat. The word pulse is probably not a very good translation there. It means vegetables that are grown from seed. In other words, give us a vegetable diet. That's what we want. And water to drink. No wine, just water. So then he says, I want this menu. I want a vegetable diet and I want water to drink. And that's a pretty good diet. I won't argue too much with that myself. So that's what he requested. And so then he said, you can examine us. And we'll let you be the judge in the matter. We won't pass judgment. You can be the judge. The males are. You have the say in whether or not we go on with the trial or whether or not it ought to be stopped. Then let our countenance be looked upon before thee. The males are doing the examining, notice. And the countenance of the children that eat of the portion of the king's meat. That's other Judeans probably that did compromise. And as thou seest, deal with thy servants. Now, wasn't that a very fair proposition when you think about it? Said 10 days is not going to make much difference out of 3 years. Why don't you let us try it just 10 days and see how we come out? Well, evidently the Melzar is a little more inclined to agree to the test than even the prince of the eunuchs was. I guess he thought, well, after all, you know, I'm just a little cog in the wheel, and I won't get much more than a rebuke from the king. But if Ashpenaz does it, he might get his head cut off. So he's going to go along with it. So that's what we have. He consents to it there in verse 14. So he consented to them in this matter and proved them 10 days. He agrees to the test. I recall another man that had a test in the Garden of Eden, and his test, he failed. His name was Adam. It concerned eating, too, of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But I recall another man, the Lord Jesus Christ, in Matthew 4, who had a trial because it concerned food, too. The devil told him, said, command that these stones be made bread. And Christ said, it's written that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. In other words, we ought to obey God rather than the devil. And so, in the case of Adam, he failed the test. But in the case of the Lord Jesus Christ, we'd say in modern terminology, he passed with flying colors. And in the case of Daniel and his three companions, they're going to pass with flying colors. So I'm glad that the test in this case was one of good results. And so we see the results now. God blessing these boys and all of that because of their willingness here to do what God had told them to do. And at the end of 10 days, their countenance appeared fair and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat. Thus Melzar took away the portion of their meat and the wine that they should drink, and gave them pulse. Evidently, during the entire 3-year period, that's what they had to eat. They never did eat of the king's meat or drink of the king's wine. They never paid homage to the gods of Babylon. Somebody said, well, now, I wonder how it's going to be, though, when they stand before the king. After all, he's got the final say, you know. It's not the Melzar, it's not the prince of the eunuchs, but it's the king himself that will decide whether or not the teachers have done their job. So let's look now at God's blessing upon these 4 young boys as we go down there to verse 17 to 21 to the end of the first chapter of Daniel. Now bear in mind that the 3-year schooling is over with. It's over with. The training period is past. And look what happened during this time. As for these four children, God gave them knowledge. Where do we get knowledge anyway? God gives it. You say, well, what about intellectual knowledge? God has to give that too. What about spiritual knowledge? He has to give that. Doesn't make any difference what kind of knowledge it is. It has to come from God. Where did Solomon get all of his wisdom to make him the wisest man that ever lived on the earth? You'll go over there and read in the book of Kings. You'll find out that God gave him wisdom and understanding. If you read in James chapter 1 and verse 5, you'll find that it says, if any man lack wisdom, let him ask of God that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. So wisdom, knowledge, understanding, whatever you want to call it, it comes from God. God gives knowledge. And so God gives them knowledge. That's what it says there. As for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. So while the other three Hebrew children had great understanding, intellectual knowledge, spiritual knowledge, Daniel had a special insight. He would see visions. He would interpret dreams. He would be more intelligent than all of them, both spiritually and physically. Then they go before the king. That's the final test now. Let me say before we leave that thought that there's nothing in Christianity that forbids the acquisition of knowledge, even the study of science. But let me point out that, like in the case of these boys, it may have many temptations along the way. So they go before the king in verse 18. The training's over with. Now at the end of the days, that is the 3 years, that the king had said he should bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king communed with them. I assume personally, individually, all of that is perhaps intended. And among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. In other words, they became courtiers in the palace of the king of Babylon. They were men in the government of the kingdom and all of that. So the king, as he talked to them and examined them personally, he found that there was no deficiency in their health due to the diet that they'd had. There was no flaw in their personality, their characteristics and all of that. There was no lack of depth of their knowledge. They were excelled all the others. They were the greatest scholars that he had in all the school that year. So then they would be given important positions in the kingdom of Babylon. We see that in more detail over here in Daniel 2, verse 48 and 49. Then the king made Daniel a great man and gave him many gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon. That's a political position, see. And the chief of the governors over all the wise men of Babylon. He was the head of all the scientists of the land. He was the chief scientist. Then Daniel requested of the king that he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king. So what I'm telling you is that this man Daniel, though a foreigner, was the right-hand man of Nebuchadnezzar the king. He was the man that he put most trust and faith in. To be a foreigner, that was an exalted position. And nobody but God could have put him in a place like that. Surely the providence of God is seen in Daniel being the right-hand man of the greatest king in the world at that time. A despised Hebrew, but yet he has that position. You know, what is the promise that Jesus made there in Matthew 6 and verse 33? He said, if you'll put me in my kingdom first, I'll add these other things to you. Now, what had Daniel done? He put God first. Did he lose anything? Did it cost him anything? Well, no. He was exalted by man, even though he had put God first. So I believe there's blessings in this world to anybody that will put God first. And I believe there's chastisement for those that do not. Daniel is an example of man that put God first. Put God first. And then there's other details that are given here in this lesson that's worthy of our consideration. They're going to find out that these boys are 10 times smarter than all the rest of them. That's pretty smart, isn't it? 2 times smarter, 5 times, but he said 10 times. Look at it. Verse 20, and in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. So he said, these fellows know 10 times as much as all these other people that I got. Well, I guess if they were that intelligent, I could begin to understand why that he might want to give them those exalted positions in the kingdom. I want to say a word here about this term magicians. Now, when you hear about magicians today, what do you think about? You say, well, that's a man's got a magic wand and he waves it around, you know, and he pulls a rabbit out of a black hat and all that sort of thing. No, that's not what it was in the time that the Bible was written necessarily. It was somewhat of a problem because when the Bible was written, what we call today science and magic was all one and the same. It was all one and the same. Sometime it was magic, sleight of the hand, and sometime it was science. So really they are not to be considered in the absolute sense men that had a magic wand, you know, and a black hat and pulled a rabbit out of it. They were scribes. They were great teachers and scientists. Learned men. You remember those kings of Orient that came when Jesus was born? They were called the Magi. That's the plural form that takes its root here from this term magician. They were men of science. They were not devil worshipers. They were men of science. And so when we read about the magicians here in Babylon, they're the sacred writers. We call them in the New Testament the scribes, would be the term we'd use. Then he talks about the astrologers. Whenever we hear about astrology today, we think about people that study the stars. That was true in a sense of the Babylonian astrologers. But they were more than that. They're sometimes called enchanters. And they were really the priests of the Babylonian religion. In other words, they were the preachers in Babylon. The priests of the Babylonian mysticism of that day. So we might say what we have here are the sacred scribes, the magicians, the scholars. And then the astrologers are the men of science, the leaders of the Babylonian religion. There was nothing in the world but the worship of the devil. That's what it was, is devil worship. Now we go down and look at verse 21. We find that God blessed Daniel not only with great possessions in this world, but with a long life in this world. And Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. Cyrus the Persian that overthrew Babylon. Now, Daniel becomes a member of the Babylonian court here at a rather early age. And he lived to be in his late 80s or 90s before he died because there's that much material here in the Bible. We go to chapter 10, verse 1. We find that Daniel is still the right-hand man of the king of Persia, Cyrus, in the third year of his reign. All right, let's do a little working here with chronology. Babylon fell into the hands of Cyrus in October of 539 B.C., 66 years after Daniel's captivity. That would make him about 81 years old or more. He continued until the third year of Cyrus. He may very well have been in his 80s or have been 90 or more before he died and was buried somewhere there in Babylon. So he not only saw the greatness of the Babylonian kingdom, for 70 years he saw this kingdom going, but he also saw the greatness of the Persian kingdom that would succeed the Babylonian kingdom. So he was blessed with old age, and he never was one that lost his testimony during all of those years that he served God in a foreign land. Most remarkable man, was he not? Well, we're going to make some practical observations here very quickly. We do not have time to elaborate on them. Number one, an education may be used to the glory of God. Moses, Paul, a good example. Let us, like Daniel, live the separated life. We're captives in the Babylonian life of worldliness. Many compromise and have no spiritual knowledge. Spiritual knowledge is spiritually discerned. Purity of heart and faithfulness to God's word comes before enlightenment in the divine mysteries. Why was it that Daniel saw all the greatness of the end time? He lived a separated life. For the martyrs of old would die before they would compromise. We today need that same courage, determination, and resolution. The song said, dare to be a Daniel. Dare to stand alone. Dare to have a purpose firm. And dare to make it known. We must have must deny ourselves and abstain from hurtful things to our bodies. Then the way to look good, to have rosy cheeks and good health, is by controlling the diet, not by painting the lips or the cheeks. A little practical point in health matters. Seven, these four Hebrews represent the godly remnant of Israel in the tribulation period to come. With that, we conclude our lesson on the book of Daniel for today.